Mayday, mayday. Is anyone out there? Anyone at all? Mayday, mayday. This forum has shut down. Repeat. Temper Clues Forum has shut down. Apparently, there's too much heat in the kitchen. And he had to get out. If I'm broadcasting, I can't tell if I'm broadcasting or not. How can you tell if you're broadcasting? Doesn't say I'm broadcasting. I'm assuming I am. So I would think the closing of the Timber Clues Forum calls for a little poetry. And it's my favorite poem by the poet Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense under the Bush II administration, dated September 12, 2002, in the Department of Defense briefing. And the poem is entitled, The Unknown. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. There are unknown unknowns, ones we don't know. Don't know. Was Donald Rumsfeld, my favorite poet, February 12, 2002, in a Department of Defense briefing. Now, as this talk was about 9/11, prelude to 9/11, in an amazing coincidence, a Mitchell bomber, two-engine bomber, it's a B-25, on July 28th, 1945, crashed into the Empire State Building, the 78th to the 79th story, killed 13 or 14 people, plus the three, the pilot, the co-pilot, and the navigator. But the building's structural integrity was not compromised. And the building, 2 weeks later, reopened for business. 11 stories caught on fire. And all the businesses were open in 2 weeks. Now, on February 26th, 1993, at 11:17, a bombing happened in the garage of World Trade Center. It blew out 5 to 7 floors, we are told, and 6 died, and about 1,000 were wounded. The plotter of this was this Yousef Ramzi. And he got other Arabs to be involved in this plot. It was found out later he was an FBI agent.
LSP-33.
I'm Rachel.
Conoco.
Original Simulant.
Robbie Parker.
This is O'Hallahan.
You are listening to Fakeologist Radio at Fakeologist.com.
Continuing, 1993, World Trade Center was bombed. Yousef Ramzi was the culprit. Turned out he was an FBI informant. FBI tried to double-cross him by blaming him for the attack. But this fellow was hip to the FBI's ways. He recorded all of his conversations with the FBI, showing that he indeed was a double agent working for the FBI. The FBI double-crossed him, gave him live ignition devices where they told him it would give him duds that so the explosion wouldn't happen. So we have an FBI a bombing in the World Trade Center. Now, 1997, PNAC program for a new American century. Talking about a century, folks, it's 21 years into it. Look where America is already. William Crystal and Robert Kagan were the chief founders of PNAC. It was heavily populated by neocons, which actually were Trotskyites. You can't make this stuff up. They call them neoconservatives, but they're actually their base was they were Trotskyites. And you can guess where they came from. They're said to be neo-Reaganites, you know, Christians. And so they stated that if a galvanizing event, such as a new Pearl Harbor happened, this galvanizing event would give them the muster to do what had to be done, which was to conquer and invade a whole laundry list of countries, Syria, Libya, Iran, Sudan, countries that had inimical relations with an unnamed country in the Middle East. It's a small country, but it's unnamed. So, fast forward, September 10th, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld holds a press conference stating that $2.3 trillion are missing from the DOD budget. This is in 2001. $2.3 trillion are missing. The accountant that's in charge of the budget, name is Dov Zakheim. He was later fired or relieved of that duty. And the Office of Naval Intelligence in the Pentagon was working on sourcing where this money went. And they had a special group in the Pentagon, which just so happens to be where explosions took place, telling all of these individuals that were working on this program and destroying the computer systems where the information was on. So we're told. So before September 11th, also, there was predictive programming in the media. We had Simpson's famous ticket, bus ticket, which had was $9, and the Twin Towers in the background, so it looked like 9/11, numerically. We had a Back to the Future movie where the DeLorean formed with the going down the road formed a 9/11. We had the movie Escape from New York, where the main character lands an airplane on the World Trade Center. We had airplane trainer video games, where airplanes were flying around the World Trade Center. We had various comics, where the World Trade Center was being cracked apart or smashed down various things. We had the band called The Coup, and it shows them underneath World Trade Centers with a baton, like he's conducting an orchestra, and the Trade Center's breaking apart. And that's just a few of the Terminator. There's 9/11 reference when Donald is being chased. And there's thousands of these references. But we also have the predictive programming of Simon Schack, who has the famous September Clues website. And I hadn't visited the September Clues website in quite a while. It's been over a decade and probably much longer than that. And under the urging of my friend, I took another look and definitely have new eyes to see. And one thing I did do was I went to the page that talked about the authors of the website, and Simon Schack is a prominent, his photographs are the only photographs of the actors behind this September Clues. And I found it very interesting that one of the photographs shows Simon Schack with his arm around a girl. He's smoking a cigarette, and he mentions that the girl is a ballerina. And if you were to interpret this photograph, you have him holding a lit cigarette. Have him, his arm around a ballerina. What are ballerinas known for? They're known for poise, being able to stand up on their toes without falling over. So when we had the dancing Israelis holding a lighter up in front of the World Trade Center, and they're photographing it and putting the lighter in front of the camera, lighting it, and showing the lighter in front of the burning towers. It's the same sort of photographic symbolism. And the second picture we have, Simon Schack, is it's a very peculiar picture because most of the time when people take a picture of themselves, they don't try to cover their faces. We have a peculiar photograph of Simon Schack. His arm is up. He has a Kabbalah bracelet on. I don't know if you know what that is, but you can look it up. And then he's covering his face with a round, like a round fist. He's covering his mouth. And in that photograph, I believe he's telling you that he is an agent. And covering his mouth, he's saying, don't tell anybody. So in those two photographs, he outs himself as an agent, and it's clear to see. He chose the photographs. I didn't choose them. He chose to do things that, if you know the meaning of them, it's quite clear what the meanings are. You can say, oh, it's just a coincidence. And so covering his mouth, as he did in the second photograph, is it's so unnatural that you just have to laugh if someone says he didn't try to make this pose the way he did. And also, you know, the first photograph being the photograph being taken on top of the World Trade Center with a ballerina, it's really, it shows that he knew what was going to happen. So he gives himself away completely here in these two photographs. You know, they speak for themselves. I did chose those photographs. He chose them. He chose to communicate what he chose to communicate. I didn't choose it. I just recognize it and call it for what it is. So apparently, going to the September Clues, and I just checked a few minutes ago, I received an email stating that Simon Shack has taken down his forum. So that means you can't go into his forum and check, you know, fact check him. He apparently he doesn't want to be fact checked, which is something that you would do only if you have something to hide. He is acting like he has something to hide, that he is a person that has ulterior motives, and it's quite clear. I think it's humorous, though, because his website has been up for, you know, over a decade, I believe. And so for this to happen at this particular point, right when Boogeyman was going to do a deep dive and to correct some of the mistakes that Simon Shack and his crew have made, I find it very enlightening. And one has to be a bit wary of someone who not take bright sunlight of investigation and truth. Not telling you what to believe, but someone is hiding information that had been up for weeks, months, and years, and they're not willing to have a debate, an open debate about it, that speaks for itself, doesn't it? So, one thing about Simon Shack, when I watched September Clues, a media fakery of the aircraft and the news feeds, and that was all very well done. Simon Shack and his crew did a good job at ferreting that material out, showing that the material had to be false. It was self-contradictory and unable to the mainstream media's video feeds were definitely CGI and fast aircraft on top of other video fakery, basically. Then you had the witnesses being media animators, photographic animators, media personalities. Then you had people on the streets where, even in some videos that weren't aired on that day, which Boogeyman showed me, that show that people were paid or influenced to say that they saw aircraft and, they directly saw it. And they saw two aircraft crash in and they were so sure of it and all that. It's so easy to tell now that they were lying and they were just paid or had some other influence action going on. The people that were real witnesses say they heard a large explosion. They felt a vibration. One woman said that when she came out, the windows were blown out, not in. And so these people seem like they were real witnesses that were mixed in with witnesses that had seen the aircraft and had certain views on it. So that's that. So kudos to Simon Shack and his crew for that. But what he does now, he switches up his game and he says that, that the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition. And he doesn't state
what that controlled demolition is. But let me tell you what controlled demolition is in the real world. In the real world, controlled demolition is that a demolition company comes in and they go through the entire building. They'll dismantle a lot of the building outright. So it'll collapse more easily. And this takes a while. You know, a lot of buildings have interior walls and interior structures that are put into the building just to make rooms and to, you know, plumbing and all these things, which have rigidity to them. So first thing they do is that they, you know, remove all these or cut them up and, you know, make them into smaller and smaller pieces and remove some of them that would be a massive hindrance for the building to crash straight down. They do want it to crash straight down. And then right before they're about to crash the building, they'll go in and the main structural elements will be cut, not completely. They'll leave a tiny bit of metal holding it up. And they don't want the building to partially collapse beforehand because that would be difficult for engineers and crews to go into. If you have a partially collapsed building, then all these other beams would be partially weakened, and it would endanger people working inside to do that. So they, you know, so what they do is they weaken it to a certain point, but it's still, the building still has rigidity, and then they put charges on critical beams that are cut almost the way all the way through, but still have rigidity, and they have it set up in a way that when those charges go off, certain charges will go off to take out the inner part of the building. And then other charges go off, so the building will collapse in on itself. So the building doesn't collapse out onto the street. So this keeps the material falling in the footprint of the building itself. And so that's how they do it. That's a controlled demolition. Now, in the World Trade Center, there was no such process going on. There was no such process. World Trade Center was a unique building. It was a building that had these giant columns that were specially made for the World Trade Center. They were hollow, rectangular beams. And the walls of these hollow rectangular beams were three times the size of armor on a tank. So that obviously it was very strong. And they were placed every 19 inches. So there was a 19-inch gap between one column and the next. And the design was unique in that these columns were able to hold the entire building vertical. There was no interior structural elements held the building up. It was these exterior columns held the building up. So this is very unusual. Most buildings have a central core. Then you put an outer wall of I-beams and whatnot. You build up like that. But this building had a central core, but it didn't support the building. This building was supported by these exterior beams that went around the entire perimeter.
They guided me with psyops.
Psychological operations.
They guided me with psyops. They weaponized psychology. Yeah. Hey.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Radio on Fakeologist.com.
And we're back. So the building was a unique building. And I believe it's Life or Look magazine There's a picture of John D. Rockefeller in front of the building as it's being constructed. He's sitting down, and building is in the background, and on his watch says 9/11. How about that? He already knew the building that was being built was going to be taken down on 9/11. And this unique design was unlike any other building ever built and any building that will be built will never be exactly like the World Trade Center building. It was a one-off. It was two-off, I guess, because there's two of them. This building was unique, and it was designed so that floors could be installed at any level you wanted. And there's some famous pictures of the sun shining through the World Trade Center where many floors are missing, and you can look right through the building with the sun setting and the light lighting up the interior of the building. And it's probably the case that building wasn't occupied the way we think it was, that it was very busy. And I had a personal experience. I lived in New York City, and I had visited many buildings in Midtown and downtown, and the lobbies were always very busy. There would be bicycle messengers coming in. There would be visitors coming in. There would be deliveries of packages and materials coming in. There were all kinds of business. And so the lobbies were incredibly busy and filled with people moving about. You would get jostled, you know, you had to move out of the way. So when the elevator opened, that these people have push carts with lots of baggage and materials could, you know, get out of there. And so you could get in. So it was very congested. But when I went to the World Trade Center, the lobby was virtually empty. And I thought, this is weird. I mean, it's this huge lobby, and the building, you know, the building was quite large, and the lobby was huge, and there was a security desk, and then there was a place where the elevator was set up so the tourists going there, they could go to a restaurant or go to the roof of the building. And I just thought there were some tourists lined up there, and I just thought, well, this is just weird. There wasn't any bicycle messengers. There wasn't any people bringing in packages. There were a couple of businessmen. But for the size of the building, it seemed odd. So I believe that on 9/11, the building was indeed very empty. And there probably were people working in there, but not the way we thought we were told, anyway. So, where was I? So the building was unique. And we had two of them. Now, when the event happened, of course, there were no airplanes. This was either analog masking, CGI, you know, it was obvious that when you're investigating that, you know, it was faked. The explosions were real. You know, was it kerosene? Is it, did they have kerosene up there? It's quite possible that they installed kerosene in certain areas and were the floors that exploded. There was an imprint of an airplane like shape, kind of like a Wile E. Coyote when he runs against the cliff, against the Roadrunner. So it's kind of funny. If you know that the beams were 12 times as thick as E-34 armor, when you count the four sides of each beam, and each beam is 19 inches from the next because of the way that building was designed, the idea of a hollow airplane with an aluminum skin smashing through that kind of steel is impossible, of course. We don't use aluminum or artillery penetrating shells from tanks. We use the heaviest material possible, which is depleted uranium. The depleted uranium has more penetrative power on steel because it's denser. So that dense material can penetrate a less dense material, just like steel. Hey. Good, how are you? Hey, I'm busy talking though. I'm on a line here. That's all right. No problem. So, the idea that aluminum and a hollow aluminum can could penetrate these gigantic steel columns is laughable. It's impossible, and the obvious explanation for the imprint on the side of the building is that this was engineered beforehand with explosives and cuts. And when the explosives happened, it knocked off pieces of the building to look like an airplane smashed into it. They didn't find any aircraft debris below except for an engine the FBI dropped off out of a van. Someone saw him drop it, but it was the wrong size engine. So that was just put there for, you know, to get realistic. But they should have used real, you know, for the airplane that was supposedly used. They had should have put that engine, not some other engine. But, you know, they were trying. So then we had the other situation, and a video that I saw, Boogeyman, I hadn't seen before, was fires, especially the fire on the second building. It looked like the fire, the smoke going up the side of the building was all even, which meant that the fire was evenly dispersed in the area inside the building, meaning that no walls or any obstructions stopped the smoke and fire from moving out the windows. So it seems like there was some sort of fire production device that was placed along the windows. And these fires creating smoke and so from out the outside, the appearance would be that there's lots of fire there. But I believe there was no fire in the interior because all these papers would get sucked out the windows and they were perfectly white, unburnt. So that could only happen if the vast majority of the building on the inside didn't, there wasn't any fires on the inside. It was just along the perimeter of the building. And, allowed these papers to be sucked up through the vortexes of heat that would suck air. Warm air rises, so the warm air would rise, it would get sucked out the windows, and the paper would just fly out the window without being burnt. And there was just tons of paper floating around. Now we come to the amazing fact that in all of the architectural history of skyscraper construction until this period of time, no skyscraper has ever collapsed from fire. And I want to repeat this because I think it's an important factoid that has not been, we have experts architects saying, oh yeah, it collapsed from the fire and this and that. Hold it. No skyscraper before this period and after this period, 2001, has ever collapsed from fire. Because kerosene is the same fire heat potential as propane. Many of us have propane barbecues made out of steel. And we cook with propane, and we have metal grates that the propane is burning right underneath. And none of us have experienced a meltdown of our propane barbecue barbecuers. So it gives you an idea of the lack of melting ability of kerosene and or propane. They provide almost the same heat potential. They're equivalent. So even if the building was completely full of kerosene and lit a fire, the building would not collapse because the kerosene fire is not able to reach those temperatures that would cause the building to collapse. They don't use kerosene or propane to melt steel. It's impossible. So that's why in any conventional fire, no skyscraper has ever collapsed in the entire world up until this point, 2001, September 11, and after 2001, September 11. No building has ever collapsed. So now we're left with a very interesting puzzle. We had three very large buildings collapse, the two World Trade Centers and Building 7. And then we had smaller buildings that were partially collapsed or destroyed around those buildings. So the idea that occurs to everyone is that, well, something brought these buildings down, of course. The buildings did collapse. Collapsed at free fall speeds, which means that there was zero resistance. Now, you use concrete, steel, and other materials because they resist gravity. And they resist it very hard. So these materials are used so that they buildings will not collapse. So this is a puzzling phenomenon that we have here. In order for something to fall at free at the speed of gravity, which means that there's no resistance whatsoever, meaning zero structural integrity in the building, holding it up. Now, of course, any of you who have been following this, and I haven't really done this work in 10, 15 years where I've been really investigating it very hard. I can tell you this, that a lot of new ideas came to the fore. And one of the ideas was a really off-ball idea of this guy Kolosov, who was supposedly a Russian nuclear engineer who worked in the Russian nuclear engineering vision of the Soviet army, that they had nuclear devices that could be used for demolition. And he came up with a really interesting idea. He said that there were nuclear weapons planted at the bottom of all of these buildings, the World Trade Center 1 and 2 at least. And these were there because you had to have a way of demolishing the building and in order to get your building permit, you had to be able to state you could demolish it. This was kind of a flimsy excuse. One thing about nuclear weapons, which I don't believe in, by the way, but that's another story. The nuclear weapons have this power to dissociate materials in the conventional. An explosion would supposedly reach very high temperatures. So any material that would be around the nuclear weapon would get vaporized. So that could, the buildings did vaporize. And that's one thing that Simon Shack, again, he tries to state that the building just fell down like a regular destruction and then the material was carted away. Well, no. The building vaporized. And there's some photographs showing there's a piece of the spire inside the building that's sticking up after the building had collapsed. And in the series of three or four photographs, you see it. You see a vaporizing.
Would you like to support Fakeologist.com and all the content we're creating? We operate on the value for value principle, where you pay whatever you can for whatever value you feel you've received. We accept donations in almost every form, from PayPal to Bitcoin. Please go to fakeologist.com/donate for your payment options. Thank you for your support. Money.
So we were talking about the different psyops that were being promulgated by various intel agencies. The Kolosov psyop, the atomic bombs in the basement, not bats in the belfry, but bombs in the basement, atomic bombs. And at the time, it seemed to have some legs because... for me, how could you vaporize, you know, the vast majority of the building like that? It seemed like you would need some sort of power that was just off the scale. And he had a sad story to tell. Let's see. Mr. Kolosov, he was put in a Thai jail. He did have an interesting thing. He said that he was having breakfast at the ex-Mossad chief's house in Bangkok, and he had the TV on. And the ex-Mossad agent said, "We've done it. We've done it." This and that, when he saw the pictures of the World Trade Center collapsing. And I thought, well, this is a very odd kind of revelation for this Russian to be making. Something didn't seem right about it, but there's nowhere else to go. Like, what did bring it down? You know, so... But again, that idea, I mean, the idea that they're putting atomic bombs in the basements of the World Trade Center,
You know, really, it just, the more you thought about it, the holes in the story of Mr. Kolesov and, you know, it just became more and more implausible. So then, luckily, we had another PSYOP where a professor from Brigham Young University who, I believe his name was Young? I'll come to me in a second. But anyway, he brought up the idea that thermite was used, or thermate. And thermite is a very hot burning material. And if you lay it on a steel beam and you set it afire, it will cut through this beam. And there are some backyard demonstrations of this beam cutting. I mean, it was very impressive. These beams were very, very thick. And, thermite and thermate, they burn through it. But they didn't vaporize it. They didn't cause the material to bend in curlicue shapes like we found with pieces at the bottom of the World Trade Center. So this was problematic. Yes, these materials could be made to burn through even three times the thickness of tank armor, times 12. I mean, you would have to have a lot of it around to burn through it. But in order for the building to fall straight down, you would have to cut these vertical columns hundreds of times each and then have them collapse in a particular way where they fell inwards. And then you would have to have all the horizontal pieces be cut too. And in order for the building to fall at the speed of gravity, it would be a very difficult demolition. Even if you disassembled most of the building and the practicality of it was almost impossible. There would be no way you could hide thermite cuts in the beams as it was happening. It would be very obvious to everyone looking at it. And that's not what happened. We didn't see. There was a couple places where it was dripping metal and stuff. Who knows what that was? But that was just a tiny bit of the building doing that, and not the vast, vast majority. So that's out, and so you're just left with a mystery there. What actually brought the buildings down? It's a mystery, and I just left it at that for a long time. Buildings don't fall down at the speed of gravity, and so you're left with mystery, a conundrum, a puzzle. This is outside, and this is the thing: it was outside the purview of normality. This is a one-off event. No steel-structured buildings have ever collapsed before, and no steel structures buildings have collapsed since. So you had one day where the laws of physics and gravity seem to have been held in abeyance, and the buildings did collapse. So what happened? Well, I just set it aside. But in the meantime, I'm always investigating things, and something caught my eye. There were these weird fires started happening around the world. Back in, I don't know if they started 2014, 2015, But fire started about then, and there was this Grenfell fire that happened on this miniature apartment complex that caught fire in London. Of course, the London group wanted that taken down, replaced, and made into modern housing. So that's what happened. And the building caught on fire, but weird stuff started happening in the building. Things were on fire that shouldn't have been on fire. Fire spread in weird ways. And it was just a puzzling thing. I studied these fires, and okay. Then another fire happened, but this time it was in Greece. And Greece fires started. Forests started burning and houses started burning. It was really weird. It was almost like the houses started on fire first and then the trees next to the house caught on fire. But the house was burning first, and they would always burn down to this white ash, which means that if you ever had a campfire, if you have white ash and there's no charcoal or anything in there, then the fire has completely burned all of the combustible materials. There's no more combustible materials. In a normal fire, the house catches on fire. One room burns out, and sometimes the whole house burns down. But a lot of times, the house will hit like a room that has, you know, tile floors and a material that's doesn't catch on fire, or just gets blackened and doesn't burn the whole house down. So many of the times the houses don't fully burn down, and you have lots of combustible materials left. But in these fires, and then there was another one in Portugal where people in cars on a highway, the cars are completely burned out, and you can see the heat marks on the asphalt. And all these people died in their cars too, which is a tragedy. They were caught there. They weren't even able to open the doors. The fire that consumed their cars was so intense, they were killed almost immediately. But the trees around the superhighway were unaffected. It was the damnedest thing. I'm just categorizing these things. I can't make head or tail of it. What's going on? Then we started having fires in California. Okay, these fires were way more they were well-documented fires. The Santa, I think, Ana fires and the Paradise fires especially. The Paradise fires was where I started seeing patterns. And these fires were very unusual in that the houses burned into this white ash, but the trees around them, the plastic garbage barrels that were located 20 feet away, were completely unharmed. And most of the trees, unless they're surrounded by burning houses, then the trees caught on fire. And was very, very strange. And then the other thing that I saw, the first time I saw that in Paradise, was that the aluminum wheel wells, and sometimes even part of the engine block, became molten, started dribbling down the driveway like water, and then, you know, it would freeze in place, and you could pick it up off the driveways along rivulet. You know, look like water, kind of, as water would be liquid, you know, going down the highway, the driveway. I'm saying, hold it, but the trees around cars were completely normal. Cars also had this rusted look to them, that windows would all be knocked out, melted inside. The cars were rusted. All the plastic, any material inside the car was completely burned. I mean, like, there was no combustibles left in the car at all. And sometimes the cars would explode or something, and they would be upside down. It was very bizarre. But in Paradise, I saw a lot of these videos. And then something went off in my head. I saw a video. And it was a house. It was totally burned down into ashes. There was rusted metal where there was I-beams. It was just all rusted, twisted metal. No material, no wood, nothing left. Even sometimes the concrete would be busted up. And then there was a car lot. A guy was a collector of cars. He had like Volkswagens and other cars, and they were completely all rusted out, and you know, just whatever material that was in the car that was combustible, completely burned out. And the camera guy is just swinging through there, and in the mist of all of these cars, burnt out wrecks, they all looked the same. They were all completely gutted and rustified. All of a sudden, there's this completely untouched stainless steel sink and stainless steel shelves that you would find like in a restaurant. Back in a moment.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Sveiki, čia Ahai Servant iš Vilniaus, Lietuvos. Ir jūs klausote Fakeologist Radio, fakeologist.com.
Hello. So, this stainless steel sink has no rust on it. It's shining in the midst of these all of these burnout cars. And I'm looking at this thing and I go, why isn't a stainless steel sink affected by these fires? It should have been affected like all the cars around it. Everything around it was all, you know, rustified out, burnt out, just like all the other material. And so I started researching, and I found a physical process that explains it. And it's called magnetic induction heating. Not many people know about this, but a rapidly fluctuating magnetic field creates resistance in steel on the surface of steel, will cause the steel to heat up dramatically. And the surface of the steel, if there's enough energy, will melt. Then the layer underneath it will start melting, and so on. Now, aluminum and copper are affected, but aluminum and copper distribute the heat more evenly. So you can melt aluminum and copper using magnetic induction heating. But since a whole lump of aluminum or copper receives the heat, then it's a more gentle heat, the copper and the aluminum. And there's induction stovetops that use this principle. And they, you may have iron underneath, but they always have a copper surface that the food lies on, because so that heat, as it comes up, will get into the copper and disperse the heat evenly so you don't burn the food. So a magnetic heating induction, it's also used now in melting of steel. So instead of having a steelworks where you have massive fires, massive kinds of melting processes, you can have a coil with a rapidly fluctuating high frequency magnetic field. And this will melt the steel. And you can do this in your own garage. You can melt steel without a flame. And one of the characteristics of a magnetic induction field is that steel only works well when steel can be magnetized. If the steel cannot be magnetized, then this field does not work very well or at all, depending on the composition of the steel. There's various levels of stainless steel that are used. But case of the Paradise fires, it was whatever magnetic induction field that was created, it was unable to melt the stainless steel kitchenware that was found in the midst of all of these destroyed cars and other metal objects. So there you have it, folks. We have magnetic induction field that can melt steel, can radiate heat. So it can, this metal can receive the heat and re-radiate it. This is why those poor people in Paradise and in Portugal and other places that were caught in their cars were unable to even open the door to get out. Heat that the car's metal received was so intense from the magnetic induction field, immediately every volatile, burnable component was ignited, causing immense amount of smoke, which probably killed the people right off when they breathed in the superheated smoke. And then they were cooked alive and probably died very quickly. So anyone in the World Trade Centers that were in this magnetic induction field, which was a very strong one, from Stony Brook, Super Collider. A Super Collider is a series of electromagnets that are said to accelerate particles around a circular path. But what they don't tell you is that it is also a magnetic induction field. And these fields can be reversed thousands of times a second, and to create a magnetic induction field, which will melt steel, aluminum, copper, cause them to glow red hot and reach temperatures of thousands of degrees in seconds, not even a second. So you saw World Trade Center, these buildings literally were vaporized in midair. So when it collapsed at the speed of gravity because there was no material holding it together. Various parts of the material pieces came apart, but the structure itself was vaporized. The tubes themselves, steel, magnetic induction heating works on the surfaces of the steel. And these specialized tubes that were built by Rockefeller acted as perfect antennas to receive the magnetic induction field. You had a square surface on the inside and a square surface on the outside. Both surfaces could be melted simultaneously. And when they turned up Stony Brook, that's when the tower went down. And they turned it up again, and that's when the second tower went down. They turned it up again, that's when Building 7 came down. But they also used it to damage and destroy some of the secondary buildings around the World Trade Center. And there's some photographs of looking from a helicopter, looking straight down. And in one of the buildings, I can't remember which building it was, but one of the buildings, there's a circular hole, almost look like if a giant had like a big steel column that was 300 feet in diameter. And he just took it and he just went, smashed it down.
and right through the roof. The only thing is, though, there's no material where the rod went through. It's like all that material had been vaporized, but on the edges, you can see where the I-beams and whatnot were pushed down by a force as it came down. So it shows you that the field was round. It was a round field, and you would expect it to be a round field. It's a coil. So that column was a coil, a magnetic induction field coil, and that building, and I can't remember which building it was, but there's just this giant round hole through the roof. No material at the bottom. You'd think like, well, some physical force knocked it down. There should be the material from the roof and the second floor and the fifth floor, or whatever, all at the building, but it's just empty. Just like this hole that opened up. Because that was vaporized. Along the edges, you can kind of see the force was down. The field came down from the sky, punched a hole there. So that's why there has been so little progress in devising why this is happening. So a weapon of this kind is a very dangerous weapon, obviously. What are guns and tanks made out of? They're made out of steel. So if you have a weapon that can turn steel into a 5,000 degree heat in 1 second, the soldiers would be fried on the inside. The tank would start to melt and blow up. All the munitions would blow up. Your gun would turn red hot and the bullet would explode. Bullets would explode. This is a very science fiction-y type weapon. Of course, they don't want you to know they have that. They want you to believe they have energy weapons, whatever that means. They don't want you to know about magnetic induction heating or have any conversations about it. So, but you can believe what you want to believe. You can look into it yourself. A lot of times I get pushback like, well, how do you know this and that? Well, I don't know if any of you have played with magnets. Well, I have, and I know a little bit about magnetism. And what happens when you take a magnet and you stick a piece of steel on it? That steel becomes magnetized while it's attached to the magnet. Now, the magnets that's stuck to usually are toys. They're not very strong magnets. But you can pick up other pieces of steel with the steel that's attached to the magnet. So a property of magnetism is once it attaches to a magnetic material now is magnetic. It's a proper of magnetism. So it did get rid of a lot of the I-beams and whatnot that survived the devastating attack. But some of them were kept for memorials across the country. And some intrepid researchers have actually gone to sites. And they've taken various instruments, and one of the instruments they took was a compass. And guess what? When they put the compass up against the steel, it starts pointing in different directions. Steel has been magnetized in different areas very strongly. There is no explanation or magnetized steel that a conventional explosion could give. There is no explanation, only that steel itself had been next to an extremely strong magnetic field and receive some of that magnetism
as a result of being in that field. There is no other explanation. All of the beams have strong magnetic moments in them. And they have some digital magnetic that you can put in your cell phone as an app. And they measure that various parts of the beams have very strong magnetic fields embedded in them. There is no explanation from thermite or thermate or from nuclear weapons or from any other conventional devices cannot induce a magnetic field in steel. There is no other explanation. But until you can find another explanation, magnetic induction heating, it's all a criteria of the motive force of bringing down the towers. It has the power to vaporize steel, especially with the Stony Brook Collider being lined up with it. It explains why cars nearby in the direction from Stony Brook were rustified, as they call it. Cars, half, some of the like fire truck, half of it will be completely rustified and destroyed, and the other half being completely normal. There's no other explanation for what's going on there. Also, there's other secondary proofs. Magnetic moment in the beams, though, it's direct proof that a magnetic field was involved in the destruction of the towers. But bank nearby had to be taken down because magnetic field was so strong that weakened the steel in the bank. It wasn't enough to bring the bank down, but caused secondary damage where the beams started to sag and various parts of the building started to give way without completely collapsing because it wasn't directly in the beam. It was just close enough to receive more ambient magnetism. So there are secondary explanations also. Also, there's explanations of the material engineering. The pyroclastic clouds that were formed had micro amounts of iron, also curiously sulfur and silica. Don't really want to get into that, but let's just say that power of these magnetic induction was so strong that it created a platform where silica and sulfur could be created out of the materials that were being destroyed. Well, I just want to leave it at that. There's a lot of other things you can talk about. I mean, the whole Pentagon thing, secondary buildings. Of course, there's the anthrax thing that was going on, which was very interesting. Of course, they had the terrorist note, the Arab terrorist note. It's so childish that, it's just hard to believe. But there were also indications that bombs were going to be tried to be set in the tunnel from New York to New Jersey. Cars were stopped on some bridges. Vans were stopped on some bridges. And people were let go. You had the dancing Israelis filming the World Trade Center, flicking their lighter in front as the camera's rolling in front of the buildings as they're burning, flicking their lighter like burn, baby, burn. So So you have a lot of different, you had the Israeli moving company where the boss was arrested. The FBI, they had penetrated a lot of secure buildings using that company. They all fled to Israel. For our ally, they don't have any, we have no way of getting any criminals back from Israel, because once they go there, they're protected. They don't have reciprocity. So their criminals can just go there and be protected in that country. So it's a Azerian mafia type situation there. But you all knew that anyway. Where else can we go with this? I'm kind of out of energy right now, so I'm just going to leave it at that. If you have any questions, you know, you can chat me up, or I can have a question and answer thing if people are interested. You know, if you don't want to believe it, if you don't want to investigate it, that's fine.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Radio on Fakeologist.com.
So, I would say that, you know, if you want to do research, if don't try to message me, and you've never read anything about magnetic induction heating, you want me to hold your hand, you want to try to say it doesn't exist when there's thousands of pages of material. That's how they make steel now. So, you know, I don't want to have any conversations with people who are so lazy that they won't even lift a finger to inform themselves. That's, you know, I don't really care. You can do whatever you want. But I just thought people should know. Now you know why the fires were happening all over the country and all over the world, what's going on about them. By the way, there's like at least one science fiction film that shows it's 1953. It's the old one. It's the day the Earth stood still and spaceship lands and, you know, near the White House and surrounded by the army with tanks and guys with rifles and machine guns, soldiers. And out of the spaceship comes an alien. He's all dressed in silver, of course. And just one guy, you know, very intimidating. And he has something in his hand. It could have been like a translator or something. He lifts it up like he's going to talk or something. And a soldier who's a little trigger happy shoots him. He falls down to the ground. He's wounded, the alien. And out of the spaceship comes a giant robot called Gort. And Gort comes down and advances towards the tanks, the soldiers with rifles. And then Gort's visor opens and out this ray comes out. And the ray melts the tank, turns red hot, and then it disappears. It vaporized. And then he melts soldiers' rifles, and they disappear. So they're showing you that magnetic induction heating is a weapon. Maybe they'll say the aliens have it. No, but we have it. It's here already. They're using it now. They're using it to create fires. They're using it to incidences like September 11. And so, you know, there is predictive programming for it, although as much as I would think, I thought there would be more predictive programming for it, but not as much as I imagined. So that's kind of interesting. But if there's interest, anybody wants to chat me up, do a little research, though. Like, look up magnetic induction heating. Watch some videos. Read about it. Inform yourself. Then at least we can have some sort of informed conversation. And at that, I bid you adieu.